Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Economics of Taste at Valletta. This talk was delivered by Marquis Nicolas De Piro.
Well, this evening we have Marquis Nicolas De Piro, quite well known, and he told me not to praise him too much. Well, I don't have words, my vocabulary is not so rich as to praise him enough. So, he's going to talk about the economics of taste at Valletta. It might appear a bit out of the ordinary, but as he will explain later on, of course, in his inimitable manner, he will talk to us about what he means by taste and its economics at Valletta. Marquis De Piro.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Salvatore wondered whether I could talk to you about my latest research, The Economics of Taste, and he added that we must have an emphasis on Valletta. I do not think he heard me say that this was almost impossible. We could have The Economics of Taste in Paris, in London, in New York, Milan, Hong Kong, but hardly just in Valletta. You will, I am afraid, have to make do with the economics of taste in Malta. And we shall pretend that the emphasis and change is all coming from Valletta. Perhaps it was, but then, as time passed, there was Slima. Our subject today is the economics of taste and the art scene in Malta. I shall not be comprehensive. Just let us acquaint ourselves with a little bit of history. Before venturing onto the trail of today's topic, I started an identity hunt to try to assess whom we are. We, the inhabitants of the Maltese Islands. I called my essay published in Treasures of Malta, On the Edge, but Not Peripheral. We are indeed on the edge of Europe, but our culture is not. Long ago, we became a bit of a spaghetti junction, perhaps more sophisticated than a lot of us could cope with. The style of some of the greatest families of Europe landed upon us, rather suddenly, and with it a fast-growing increase of the small number of inhabitants prior to 1530. Because of our population, because it grew, perhaps as much as tenfold within the first 100 years of the arrival of the knights, it is not difficult to conclude that as many as 9/10 of our origins descend from the European Christian followers of the Order of St. John. We were destined to become the southernmost castle of Christianity in Europe, impregnable, proud, and sovereign. We proceeded to become de facto executives in many branches of the Order's hierarchy and activities, a Maltese Grand Prior, Maltese Segreti, a number of them in fact, and as was the case before the knights, we produced Jurati. There were, more importantly, Maltese Uditori, almost like a prime minister, the right hand of a grand master, the most famous being Fabrizio Grech, who built Villa Bologna for his daughter. We had a Maltese bishop, Baldassare Cagliaris, who became very important. He built a palace in the very heartland of the order, in Valletta, right here in the middle of the convent city of the conventual order. There was also a Gossetan contender for the bishopric. It is true that he did not make it, but a contender he was. And he was a member of the order. His name was Fra Pietro Stiges. We Maltese became procurators of wheat, who had to command and take ships abroad and carry gold in order to fill up the granaries with essential stocks. There were Maltese officers in the army of the order, procurators and warrant holders of the Holy Inquisition, curators of the Holy Office, junior officers and colonels of the Royal Sicilian Regiment, Maltese administrators of the magisterial palaces, Maltese administrators of magistral lands. One, Gaetano Azzopardi, later to become a nobli, for a period was the holder of very high office as protomedico of the Sacra Infermeria, All this, and I have not mentioned Girolamo Cassar and other Maltese architects, it is from this historically secure and overlooked reality that I base my judgment on our present-day attitude to life. Our confidence vis-à-vis anybody else from any level in any part of the world is strong and healthy. It is perhaps exaggerated and blown up, giving us a sense of freedom and high self-esteem. Malta, fior del mondo, we've heard that. Whether this pride versus humility is a good thing, I do not know. What I cannot help observing is the fact that it has affected our taste and kept up our morale. My little venture today is to look into the economics of our taste, to identify it, and to give you at least some of the picture I am trying to paint. I shall not start with Malta, but will address the subject at first in general. If we stay within our lifetimes, and I suppose a fair quantity of us can look back to the 1960s, let us consider what we should have bought in order to have made the right choice. A large Maltese silver coffee pot of the 18th century in the 60s cost £100 to £150. The item has gone up about 30 times in value. A house in Hampstead has gone up perhaps 600 times in value. Villa Upper Bologna was on the market at the time and has now gone up about 30 times to something over £1 million. That is, if you had it untenanted and you had not grudgingly sold it to pay off death duties, it would be even more valuable as a building site. Had you bought a 19th century landscape by Gianni in the 60s, you may have thought you were paying a lot. They were becoming fashionable. 10 years earlier, my mother bought one in Valletta for £20. She was criticized by members of the family for wasting money. 10 years later, Gianni's were up 700%. Since then, they're up another big leap, and a very good one can command a price of anything between £10,000 and £15,000, and I'm not quoting record prices. A few years ago, Richard England was approached by a building contractor who asked, "Signor, my wife wants a Jamri," meaning Gianni. "Tell me what I should do. Today I can put £10,000 up my..." This is a bit difficult to translate. "I can afford £10,000. Shall I buy one or not?" Richard answered, "Let me tell you what you should do. Make out a cheque for £10,000, frame it and hang it on your wall." Gianni's pictures were easy to understand. They were meticulously painted, lots of detail of places which had changed with development. The fashion for Gianni's flared up in the 1980s, with Melitensia Art Gallery and one or two others picking up most of the topography in the 1990s and selling it on to all the local Joneses vying to keep up with each other. Now back to 1950. It is December, just before Christmas. Some incredible things are happening on the Maltese art market scene. The Monsignor Giuseppe Vassallo sale has set people talking. One big industrial family in Malta paid £700 for a picture. They were clever and took sound advice from Vincenzo Bonello. He was one of less than a handful of locals that included Gianni Cauchi and the historian Hannibal Scicluna, who really knew anything at all about art. Within his parameters as a museum curator, Bonello, with a very small budget, focused mainly on old masters. He was able to enhance the national collection and personally owned a picture creditable to Caravaggio. Collectors, if they sought it, were lucky to have his advice. The Vassallo sale produced pictures which turned out to be of real importance, and the government was neither bidding nor was it to take advantage of its right of preemption where it mattered. Through his fingers slipped a Jan Bruegel the Younger, a probable Filippino Lippi, and a large altarpiece, which subsequently the restorers at the Capo di Monte Museum in Naples, while cleaning it, suggested was none other than the work of Hans Memling. The Flemish triptych bought by Monsignor Upper Bologna at the same sale, he paid £400, would, some 10 years later, realize enough hard cash to pay off a quarter of what were considered to be crippling death duties on his estate. Then came Mrs. Lawson's sale. She was born a Saint Fournier and lived in a palace in St. John Street, Valletta, sadly almost demolished, gutted on the inside, turned into a cinema for a bit. My first auction sale, 10 armorial Maltese silver dining plates of the Order of St. John, did not sell. Nobody bid. They were sold next day for £70, the weight value of the silver, the current weight value at the time. Monsignor Upper Bologna died in 1962. He left no will, except that he whispered into the ear of his confessor before expiring that the two nieces who had often looked after him should have his Imdina house. The heirs agreed. His auction sale attracted many people. Hans Bacher came from Christie's in Rome, and with him Fabrizio Apolloni, who was married to Bulgari's daughter. Apolloni told me that never in his life had he entered a house to find that there was no 19th century in it. Everything, including the kitchen cupboards and utensils, were 18th century or older. You cannot make a mistake here, he said. The kitchen cupboards started at 10 shillings. They were bought by Apolloni for £60. Everybody was aghast. They turned out, after removing the yellowy-white paint covering them, to be a Venetian library with crackler of green and gold underneath. They were bought eventually by Gianni Agnelli, who put them in the study of his favorite home in Italy. Well, now, within the scope of Maltese taste, a picture of the beheading of John the Baptist, a large painting attributed to Leonello Spada, whose murals are all over the Magisterial Palace in Valletta, made something in the region of £200. And a huge full-length Christ embracing the cross, perhaps better than the one at the Museum of Fine Arts, attributed to Guido Reni, sold for £90. The most beautiful Maltese bureau bookcase made £500, and another with positively exquisite chinoiserie, something quite incomparable, superb, made all of £700. People gasped. Things were really taking off. Or were they? I heard somebody say after the sale of a beautiful Madonna, as far as I am concerned, it's just a piece of canvas. How could it be worth the same as a small place in Valletta? Another great sale followed the death of Marchesa Adelina De Piro in the early 1960s. She had no children and had lived perhaps a little beyond her means. She kept a flat in Monte Carlo and a lovely house in Lia, which she often let furnished to the manager of Shell. She had sold all her full-length Favre portraits of the knights to Carmelo Casartorigiani for his now-demolished palace on the Slema front. He was considered mad to have spent £100 on each. His brother, the founder of the National Bank of Malta, asked him, "How often do you look at them in a year? Do you know how much it is costing you in interest to flick your eyes in their direction?" Two remaining Antoine Favres, which she kept until her death, described as historical subject in her eventual sale, landscapes with figures, were confirmed by Vincenzo Bonello as being right. Favre. They were sold at her sale 20 years later to pay death duties by all the heirs. They made £280 each. What was the average need, taste, desire of a Maltese collector? What did people want? I suppose they wanted things to give them prestige, things which looked as though they came out of a grand house. By the 18th century, portraiture became fashionable among the Maltese, and it's interesting to note that today portraits of ladies are usually more valuable than portraits of gentlemen, especially if the ladies are young and beautiful. The 19th and 20th centuries have given us an abundance by artists such as Allingham, Giuseppe Calì, Edward Caruana Dingley. Given a choice, I do not have to tell you that most of us buying a picture for purposes of decoration would turn down the portrait of Chief Justice Sir Giuseppe Carbone and opt for a peachy-looking Mrs. Galianaudi, so there's no question about taste here. Of course, this is not always the case, as we have those not only interested in the aesthetic, but also in the historical aspects of a picture, irrelevant of its beauty. But first, I have a story which takes us back to very soon after World War II. A Maltese businessman is in the south of France and meets Pablo Picasso on the beach. They get on well. They're both a bit rough, and both, in differing ways, highly talented. Both had a bit of that eyahamoru, let's get on with it, attitude to life. Picasso finds our compatriot simpatico. He asks him over to his studio and tells him he should buy two of his works at a greatly reduced price and take them to Malta. I believe we're talking about something in the region of £300 each, an investment which our Maltese businessman could afford. Our businessman jokes, as if. He thinks all that cubism and distortion is junk. He says, no. He is pressed. He still says, no, not this time, thinking that he has no money to throw away. And anyway, would they impress anybody in Malta? Instead, perhaps to please his wife, yes, definitely to please his wife, our businessman buys two Louis Cannes type portraits in very fancy, heavily gilded frames. It was only discovered after he and his wife were dead that these pictures were modern fakes covered in yellowish varnish to make them look old. Our Maltese businessman eventually died, a wealthy man, one of the wealthiest on the island. Had he taken proper and perhaps expensive advice, had he tried to understand, had he not trusted his own judgment, which did not serve him in this case, he might have recognized this unique opportunity. Had he bought the two Picassos and left them in a bank, he would have left a fortune perhaps 10 times greater than he had amassed in a lifetime of endeavor and hard work. With all our culture, Maltese collectors did not buy impressionists when they were cheap, nor did they buy fauves, cubist, abstract, and post-impressionist work. Our museums hardly sniffed at the 19th century, and sadly, they are now understocked of the works of that great romantic and artistic Victorian century. Here is a lesson for us all. How boring it is to hear, I know what I like and I know what I don't. So what? If I were rude, I would answer, you only like what you like because you are uninformed. You would invest your savings more soundly, far better, if you knew what you were doing. Please understand, this does not mean that you cannot choose to become a stamp collector or even a collector of old bottles. But if you do, you really should learn all about your subject and do it well. There is, in fact, somebody in Valletta, see, I'm mentioning Valletta, who has amassed an impressive collection of old bottles. Let us return to modern art. The number of active, abstract artists we have showing their works at St. James Cavalier and the Manuel Courtyard, etc., is all becoming a bit of a tsunami. The truth, of course, is that we are now in a postmodernist period, and abstract as old hat. That does not mean that there are not abstract pictures of great value to be collected, but I am afraid that the ones that are being produced now, if they are good because they are decorative and not because they are great. New collectors will often tread into unknown waters and start to drown. My simple advice is do not try to be too clever. Avoid what somebody selling you something tells you is a bargain. Always take advice. I was asked to visit a house a couple of years ago because the owner apparently wanted some advice from me. He took me into his study and said, "Look, look there. Isn't it wonderful?" They, whoever they were, did not want to sell it to me. He was pointing at a desk. "Look," he went on, "what nice sculpture, 18th century, unique in Malta." They owed me a favor. That is why I got it. I was hardly given the opportunity to say anything until he had finished assuring me that I probably had not seen the likes of his desk. "And," he continued, "only £20,000. Can you believe it?" I answered quite honestly, "No, I can't," I said. "Let me look carefully." This was not necessary. The desk was certainly not more than about 50 years old. I had seen things similar in Lott's Road, off the far end of the King's Road in London. There, under the hammer, they could make as much as £300 to £400. Aya, let us be generous. Let us say at best £1,000. If I were to tell this man that he had been had, he would return to the vendor. The vendor would say, "Who told you this?" I felt my life was in danger. A bit of quick thinking, as the owner of the desk said, "You like it?" I walked across the room and said, "Where did you get this picture? It's absolutely charming." "I bought it at Belgrava Galleries from Joseph and Musée for £600. "Prosit," I answered, "what a bargain. Is it it is Venetian 18th century and worth 10 times that." Phew. He did not go back to the desk, and I headed towards another room. We had a drink. I looked at my watch. It was soon time to leave. At the front door, he said, "And you like the desk?" I answered, "What can I say?" He answered, "And they didn't want to sell it to me." Malta in the 19th and 20th centuries saw the soaring popularity of Giuseppe Calì, Edward Caruana Dingley. There were other locally established artists, including the Schranzes, Bellanti, De Angelis, both father and son, Vincenzo Fenech, Helen Gallia, Krasnov, Edward Lear, Robert Caruana Dingley, somebody called Jorg Stieve, Gianni Vella, both Willy and Censu Apap, Antoine Camilleri, Esprit Bartek, Almero Mangione, and Arcidiacono. Calì and Caruana Dingley now probably command the highest prices paid for 20th century Maltese artists. Willy and Censu Apap are having their day, and Antoine Camilleri and Esprit Bartek are doing well. Mangione and Arcidiacono's reputation is taking off. Mangione, I believe, is among the greatest of our moderns, but I suggest you try somebody else for a second opinion. In about 1965, Peter Apollonia and I, both aged 23, bought about 50 maps of Malta in Paris from a well-established dealer. The price was minimal, probably less than one of those maps would be worth now. And the items were genuine. There were great names among them: Michelot et Bremont, Coronelli, Homan, Vischer, etc. We brought them back to Malta and sold them very quickly and with the greatest of ease. We were soon in Paris again, this time happily ensconced in the Grand Hotel Prince de Galles on the Avenue Georges V and both young and anxious to improve our culture. While on the subject of maps, I should like to pay tribute to Albert Granado, that very thorough man of letters who has assembled the finest collection of Maltese maps in the world. He has published 2 volumes about Maltese maps of the 1500s and another volume about maps of Valletta. Much of his collection was bought for low prices, but when he felt that he had to purchase something that was missing, he was brave and dug deep into his resources. The result need not be considered in money terms, but if we did just that and thought about his collection as an investment, he now proves to have been brilliant. Albert Granado has also amassed a great book collection with an emphasis on Malta and events concerning us. When a book is really rare, it is often only Albert Granado who has one. The 1980s did see a newfound appreciation of contemporary Maltese artists, moving on from Caruana Dingli to Manjon and Bellia, followed by a string of girls, Anna Grima, Isabel Borge, Madeline Gera, and my sister Mary DePiro. Mary was contracted to supply the new Central Bank of Malta with very modernistic interpretations of prehistoric sites. The other artists' works are today all well placed in good collections. All are safely established. With the birth of Pacheville had come a new gust of wind blowing through our streets and homes. It's still before independence, and George Borge Olivier visits David West's Mazarin Gallery. Mark Burley is sniffing around the place, trying to buy a couple of houses, which he plans to turn into a Maltese Annabelle's. Valentine Brown opens a modern art gallery in an Imdina cellar. Galleria Fenici will open in Valletta. And I remember meeting a long-haired Dennis Vella there. Richard England, of course, is a young man, and he is collecting modern Italian artists, among them Guttuso and Fontana, a wise man. He's not too interested in his father's famous stamp collection. He is budding with modernity. He encourages my sister Mary to paint white on white. It works, and she sells. Ralph Arrigo started his rise to financial stardom on the back of antiques. He sold bureaus and kept a table topped with perhaps as many as 20 to 30 18th century sottocoppas in his hall. He became a great source for really good furniture. Galianaudi in those days was already on the ball, and he too supplied some of the top collectors. Michael Appa Bologna by the 1990s had amassed perhaps the finest collection of Maltese views, followed closely by JZT and then eventually Vivian Bianchi. Mr. Calero, the property man, was collecting in London, as was indeed nightclub owner Joe Brulot, who never missed a Saturday at Portobello. Always found Maltese things at Portobello. You've got to think in terms of the tradition of selling pictures to people who visited in the Navy, Jannies and things, and they would end up in England and then 2 or 3 generations later come on the market there. For Christmas 1985, the Osborne Gallery at 21 Grosvenor Street, London W1, here I must confess I was involved, gave an exhibition of Maltese pictures for sale. I've converted the sterling to Malta pounds, which we still understand, I haven't done it to euros, to the nearest round figure. A lovely Giovanni Schrant sunset over Grand Harbour, a good size oil made 800 sterling. A lovely Michele Bellanti harbour scene, 290. Edward Caruana Dingli. Many people in this picture, good sized oil, several figures, a Malta fish market, 2,200. Charles Brockdorff, Maltese country family, £290. Coming to the fore, this man, Nicola Camilleri, we kept finding, not Camilleri, spelled very differently, with many more L's and things. Anyway, shipwreck, £90. Today he is well established and a known artist of the 19th century, but not so well known at the time. A fair-sized Girolamo Gianni, one of his better oils, made just over £1,000, and another Girolamo Gianni of St. Paul's Bay, now people would drool over this, made just £1,000. So it's 1985, and the exhibition of 34 items was almost a sellout. The most expensive items went first. Good names. In those days before the publication of the Dictionary of Artists who painted Malta, some good names like Norman Wilkinson, Leslie Cole, the war artist, McFall, and even the great Turner-esque Thomas Allam, who had all worked here, were still not selling well and were virtually unknown in Malta. By the end of the 1980s, Maltese dentists were doing remarkably well, and one in particular became a major collector of furniture and maiolica, and another a lover of modern art. Some collectors never even graduated into the 19th century and preferred to stick to dark oils of painful martyrdoms, allegorical subjects like love losing her innocence, or charity with a handsome young woman breastfeeding her father through a prison grid. Also, large landscapes in heavy gilt frames, very decorative, but generally copies of versions of famous paintings and therefore of dubious commercial international value, but still popular in Malta. The late Dr. Jimmy Farrugia was now almost dominating the silver scene with Victor De Nara's first book on Malta silver under his arm. He bought and he bought and he bought. His name came up at Christie's and Sotheby's all the time. I must not exaggerate it. There was another formidable collector collecting Maltese silver, whose name perhaps I should not mention, with incredibly good taste. He put together an outstanding collection and was able to keep an eye on the markets, not only in London, but also in New York and other parts of Europe, including Rome and Paris. He has repatriated some really important national treasures, and we are grateful to him. Yet another collector, Paul Zammit, and also coming to mind are names like De Maio, Prea, Kazampats, or Pardi. We should remember that those who own good silver are not always collectors, and for the purpose of today's talk, I wish to sideline the palaces of Imdina and the three villages, and especially mention collectors and their achievements. In Valletta, for those who still lived here, the better pieces were not kept in the Villeggiatura house, but in Valletta, where the grand drawing rooms were. A certain other collector in our audience today, whom I dare not mention, has amassed one of the finest collections in private hands in Malta. The Golcher collection of Palazzo Falzon is now ably displayed and lovely to see, and here comparisons are not odious. This particular collector, if his collection ever sees the light of day, if it is ever put on public display, will stun us all, as his collection surpasses what Golcher achieved, and Golcher did achieve. Most of the pieces comprising the collection are prime examples. It is all very well to say I've got a Favre or a Mattia Preti. The thing is, are they outstanding works? A particularly good work by an artist might fetch 10 or 20 times his usual price. This holds good for the ebonist, the carpenter, cabinet maker, an average bureau or a stunning bureau, the goldsmith, the sculptor, and so on. Let's go a little banal, yes, a good Picasso or a below average Picasso. You can count the difference in millions. One character I have heard about apparently was famous for having the largest collection of the worst pictures by the finest artists. Not so people like Gianbuddha Caruana, and indeed not so the collection at Palazzo Falzon. People who have a collection often have their favorites. You can't help that. I remember David Carrot, ex-director of Christie's, and then a world-class works of art investor operator. He ran a multi-million pound company called Artemis. And because of his inclinations, he would soon be nicknamed Artemis. He once told me that whenever he visited a house, he was usually shown what his host or hostess thought were the best items in their collection. More often than not, he said, it was that little picture or piece of sculpture tucked away in the corner that was the plum of the collection. More often than not, the Van Dyck, the Caravaggio or Rembrandt were copies, and telling the owners was difficult indeed. I personally remember a case where a picture was mentioned in the will of the only Maltese cardinal, Fabrizio Cheveras, Il mio quadro del Murillo. It was, in fact, an early 19th century copy on 19th century canvas. I said this to the owners, gently explaining that although the Pope had given it to the cardinal, Pius VII probably had a few copies of this delightful Madonna, made to give as presents. It was no good. They persuaded themselves that I was wrong. Davvero mai afsh. He's a fool. I think that they did find somebody to tell them what they wanted to hear. Probably somebody who was going to sell them something, which of course he would authenticate. C'est la vie. I have not mentioned a character who in the 60s became one of the best upmarket dealers. He was known as Pitur Borch, and he lived in an impeccable little house called Villino San Antonio. He is now in his late 80s and almost completely housebound. His manners, I remember, were perfection, and everything in his house was arranged as though it belonged there. Frank Borch restored pictures and dealt in Favres, Mattia Preti, Schwanz, and various antiques. He became fashionable, and he himself painted Flemish-looking flower pictures for the dining room, and chivalric battle scenes for the sitting room, even for the hall if you want. They sold merrily right through the 60s and 70s, and even now they turn up at auction sales. A small pair of Mr. Borch's pictures sold in England recently, I don't know what the buyers thought they were buying, for quite a hefty four-figure sum. Good for him. A small piece, he was not cheap, ever, but everything he supplied looked good. His frames, his mounts, and so on. He did not like to be called a dealer. Excuse me. I am a connoisseur. If I sell from my house, it is my things I sell. End of story. The dealers who made fortunes were Paolo Borch, who had a shop in the Narrabri-Kirkara back street. I remember him early days buying unsold lots and offering 10 shillings or a pound for bundles of 18th century copper. By the time he died, he was a rich man. I remember asking him once if he had any gran spinat, gold chains for those of you who don't know, of a particular pattern used in Malta and often seen in old portraits of the ladies, and indeed even worn by bishops. Yes, sir, I believe I have something. And after rummaging around for a bit, he opened a drawer and brought out a box which was full to the brim of these valuable chains. Perhaps the most important of these dealers was Paul Tanti, who lived in a large house in Battery Street in Valletta. He had started off as an upholsterer's assistant in the late 1940s. He was self-taught and would develop an excellent eye for items of quality. Listen to this. As he started to establish his business, he must have done a house clearance and then sold off some items which paid for the lot. However, left over were four rather grotesque paintings, very heavily varnished and consequently looking yellowish. They represented human figures made up of fruit and vegetables. They were, unbeknown to him, the four seasons, spring, summer, autumn and winter. He tried to sell them. They didn't look very pretty, and finally succeeded in selling one to a policeman for half a crown, which is 2 shillings and 6 pence, I don't know what it is now. Apparently the policeman's wife turned up with the picture next day, demanding her husband's money back. Paolo put the four pictures into an auction sale in Malta, and to his evident delight, they made £17 each. Pitur Borch cleaned them, and they looked good. Very colourful, most unusual. Time passed, and some way through the Mintoff period, when many of our families felt threatened, a foreign dealer turned up at the owner's door and offered £5,000 in cash for the set. Off they went. They were next seen in the 1980s at Sotheby's. Four pictures attributed to the Italian artist Giuseppe Arcimboldo, 1527 to 1593. They made somewhere in the region of £60,000 then. Had the policeman bought them all, they would have cost 10 shillings, or half 1 pound sterling. It is surprising to think that they would sell for 120,000 times the original asking price. When an artist dies, his work normally gets a financial boost. If this does not happen, he is in danger of being forgotten, and often quite quickly. If he has never sold a picture, it is possible he will be forgotten for the wrong reasons. Gianni Caivanadingli, Esposito, Schwanz and Kali are safe and sound because many people have one or more of their works in their homes and offices. Envin Cremona, too, is in countless collections, but less so Carmelo Mangione, who did not seem to have wished to sell his pictures and is just as important. Let us wind this up. Malta has been a good place in which to be a collector. Valletta has been one of the loveliest places in which to live in. Most of the things we have bought over the past decades, we do not regret buying. Most have gone up in value, as I have explained, some much more than others. I once asked old Mr. Ledger of Ledger Galleries in Bond Street, who makes most money buying antiques? Who are the most successful? His answer was a bit of a surprise. He said, those who go to Sotheby's and Christie's and buy the most expensive lot in any sale. I said, why? He answered, it's like this. The item people pay most for is the thing most people want. It will go up faster in value than any bargain you could make. Its potential to resell for profits should be swift. Beware of bargains, my boy. Avoid them like the plague. A good argument, but, oh dear. Had you listened to people like Kenneth Clark and Dennis Mann, who both sanctified the Seicento when, between the 30s and the 60s, the artists of the Seicento abroad were very out of fashion? Kenneth Clark, the author of that great book, Civilization, of course, brought a luxury liner into Grand Harbour, not scheduled to come here, because nobody on his lecture tour had ever even heard or seen of Caravaggio or his works. Dennis Mann did a deal for a Caravaggio at that period in the 60s with another bidder in an auction sale who was only interested in buying the frame. I think he was going to turn it into a mirror. You need experts. We all need experts as we live in a country, in a Europe, where a great deal of politicking will, one day, in the future, become redundant. We are approaching a situation where, with the help of education, the ideologies will merge, and it will be good and ideally an honest management that counts. Ladies and gentlemen, all we need is good advice and a little bit of flair. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know how we are for time. Am I answering questions?
Once there are no questions to be asked, I thank you very much for your explanatory lecture this evening. And I would like to invite you all to our next lecture, as I said, on the 28th April at La Borza. And please, before leaving, I'd like all of you to have a little thought and a little prayer for our President, Professor Mario Bahajar, who is very, very sick. In fact, he's at the ITU. So please, your help and your prayers would be most appreciated. And thank you very much, and hope to see you at our next lecture. If anybody is interested in the Historical Society, I can give him just a free copy. Perhaps he's interested, I give it free to him. Okay, thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Economics of Taste at Valletta. This talk was delivered by Marquis Nicholas De Pirro.